Welcome to this session on eating for sustainability, peace, and spiritual health. I'd like to call on Charlie Talbert, a member of the UFIDA board, to introduce our speaker. Charlie?
Thank you, Meredith. We are fortunate to have with us today the author of a book that offers hope for the looming and seemingly intractable problems that humans are facing around the planet. The World Peace Diet is a unique contribution to understanding the connection between the vast range of the world's problems: hunger, poverty, disease, violence, environmental degradation, and the exploitation and slaughter of billions of defenseless animals each year, which all too many people do not consider a problem at all. Will Tuttle has a master's degree in humanities from San Francisco State University and a PhD in the philosophy of education from the University of California. A professional pianist and teacher, he has for the last 17 years spoken at churches, seminars, conferences, and intentional communities throughout North America and Europe. He has taught college courses in philosophy, humanity, mythology, and comparative religion. He trained in Korea as a Zen Buddhist monk. Now, he's here with us, and it's my pleasure and honor to welcome Dr. Will Tuttle.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you all for joining us here. You must be the courageous ones in this room here. Look at this, as Charlie said, the taboo. I'd like to just begin our really very brief time we have together this afternoon by just taking a moment and turning our attention within, just for a moment, and just feeling our connection with our loved ones, with each other, with the whole web of life, and know that we are part of an infinite benevolent mystery. We give thanks for the precious opportunity of a human birth to awaken to wisdom and compassion and to be part of a movement to raise consciousness on this planet. And we give thanks knowing that all of the ripples that radiate out into our world from our being together this afternoon will be to bring wisdom and understanding and healing into our world. For the power and presence of the Infinite Spirit indwelling, we give thanks, knowing this is so, and so it is. So I'm just grateful, really, honestly, to all of you for being here, and I'd like to, as Charlie said, talk a little bit about the main ideas in the book that we just heard about, the World Peace Diet, how they came about, what I think the implications are for us, not only as individuals, as Unitarians, as a movement, and what we can do to help bring true peace and healing into our society and into our world. I'll say at the beginning that, and actually what I'd like to do also at the end is bring some a little bit of music into the event, and also have an opportunity, hopefully at the end, for some questions. The basic idea, the basic theme of the World Peace Diet book is that all of us have been born into a culture that has at its very core a certain mentality. This mentality is pervasive, vast, and invisible. But it is a mentality that has at its core seeing beings as things. We learn, like anyone who is born into any culture learns the worldview of their culture. It gets ritually injected into us. And our consciousness gets programmed by this, and we look with eyes that our culture has programmed to see in a certain way. That mentality is a mentality of commodification of living beings. It's a mentality of privilege. It's a mentality of exclusion. It's a mentality of domination, exploitation, and oppression. That is the living core around which our culture is organized and maintained primarily through the rituals of daily meals where living beings are turned into things. We are taught from a very early age to disconnect the reality that is on our plate from the reality that it took to get it on our plate. We become masters through practice of the fine art of disconnecting. And we learn to disconnect from the effects of our actions. And so true intelligence, whether it's ethical intelligence or cognitive intelligence, is the ability of our consciousness to make connections. So if we are going to solve the problems on this planet and learn to live together in harmony, peace, wisdom, sustainability, justice, and equality, we are going to have to learn to reconnect. To reconnect with our fundamental wisdom and to reconnect with the consciousness I think we all had perhaps before we went through this programming, which is knowing the interconnectedness of all life and the fundamental spiritual teaching, which is of the interconnectedness of the welfare of all living beings. We are all connected on this planet, and the mentality of separation gets itself into us at the deepest level through our meals. That's where it really happens. And the sense of grief, I think, that we experience at such a deep level culturally is so great that this is the great taboo. We are very fortunate, I think, to be in a movement where we can actually stand here and articulate this. Because it's very difficult for me to articulate this in the mass media. I call it the military-industrial meat medical media complex. And it is a vast complex. And it all works together to maintain a system of control. A wealthy elite seems to benefit from this. However, all the other beings suffer enormously. So to understand our predicament, we have to somehow extricate our consciousness from its programming. And it's almost like stepping back from the earth somehow and looking and going, oh my goodness, you know, why doesn't anyone see this? It's so obvious, and yet it's invisible because it is so deeply rooted in our way of seeing. We don't even have words. We have words for veganism, you know, or these words that, you know, for seeing, for not eating animals. There's no word in our language for the philosophy or the way of seeing that sees animals merely as things to be eaten. We have to say it. We don't have a word for that. So this is really, I think, what's literally and figuratively on our plates as a culture right now, is to awaken to a higher level of consciousness of inclusion that includes all sentient beings. We know, all of us know, that vertebrates, for sure, other mammals, birds, fish, all vertebrates have the same basic nervous system that we have, and they can feel pain, and they are endowed with the capacity to suffer, and that they also experience social and pain as well, psychological pain as well. Anyone with a dog or cat knows, is very aware of this. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about my own journey in the beginning, because I think that's a good way to understand sort of how, you know, how these ideas came to me, and then to understand how we can understand at a deeper level the ways that we can solve and create solutions, you know, really create solutions to the indoctrination that we've all endured. I was born in Concord, Massachusetts, and raised there, born into a family of basically people like everywhere else, I think, that ate huge amounts of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and I never questioned it, honestly. I was told, these animals, you have to eat this. You will die if you don't eat this. So, but I think it was maybe helpful in my case to have been born in Concord, because there was such a presence of the transcendentalists. Actually, there's two revolutions that happened in Concord. One was the revolution of 1775, and every April 19th, my father, along with other men in the town and in the surrounding towns, would dress up like Minutemen, and they'd go down, and they'd walk down to the Old North Bridge, and we'd all shoot at the other men that were dressed up like redcoats, and we'd send them back to Boston shooting, you know, and we'd kind of like cheer for the revolution. So I actually, in some kind of perverse way, I mean, maybe it wasn't perverse, but it was a good way, I think, for myself, was raised with this idea that revolution is a good thing. You know, that if you have a situation that's oppressive, that's, you know, intolerable, then you change it. You make a change. And And I think that's really in our culture's heart of hearts. Our culture yearns for a revolution, a benevolent revolution, a complete transformation in the seat of consciousness of our culture. And that transformation really, I believe, and I'll talk about this later, is learning to see beings as beings, not as things. And the other revolution that happened maybe in the mid-1800s is called the Transcendentalist Revolution. I was, learned to swim in Walden Pond. I was born in Emerson Hospital and went to Alcott School. And all these guys, their whole, life I was just sort of immersed in. And I found out really not till later when I was in college and graduate school how much they really imbibed the spirit in many cases of Asia. Thoreau had the largest library in the whole United States back in 1845 of books from the Taoist tradition, the Buddhist, the Hindu, the Vedantic traditions. And part of this, these ideas that they were bringing into our culture back then, one of the main ones was the idea of ahimsa, which is the idea of nonviolence, that true happiness comes only when we live a life where we don't cause suffering to others. And so perhaps on some level I was tuning into some of this as a little kid growing up, but I remember my mother mentioned, it just sticks out in my mind when I was maybe in second grade, she said, well, there are vegetarians. And I said, what? And she said, well, yeah, there are, I think I must have asked her why we're always eating this meat or something. And she said, but she said it like they lived on another planet somewhere, it's like nobody we ever knew, this was back in the 60s. But so later, though, I had a chance to visit Fruitlands, which is a community started by Bronson Alcott and his family and some other people with money from Emerson, where they actually lived as vegans in Harvard, Massachusetts. And it's amazing to go there and just see, they wouldn't wear any, they wouldn't eat any animal flesh or any dairy products or eggs. They wouldn't wear any leather or silk, and they wouldn't even, these people wouldn't even wear cotton because it came from slave states back in the 1850s. So they were very hardcore vegans, even though that word wasn't invented until 1944. And I think this is an incredibly powerful statement that was made back then of living in this way, to truly, as Gandhi said, to align one's life with one's values. And but when I remember one thing, when I went away to a camp in Vermont when I was 11 years old. It was called Camp Challenge, and this camp was designed to challenge us in positive ways through outdoor living, and it was affiliated with the ultimate organic Vermont dairy farm. The same people owned it. And so we would go down to this farm from time to time and work there. And I remember at one point we went down and there were some chickens running around, and we were shown how to catch the chickens, how if you hold the chicken with one hand on this board with two nails in it and put her neck through the nails, and then with your other hand you have your axe and you cut her head off and watch her run around with no head bleeding. I remember not being that fazed by that, because even by the age of 11, I was completely indoctrinated that animals do not have a soul. They were put here by God for us to eat. You will die if you don't eat them. So get over it. This is life. And that's how I was for sure raised. And but I remember about a month later, we were at the camp, and this time we went down, and instead of chickens, there was a cow on the floor of the barn, standing in the barn. And the owner of the camp told us that she was not giving enough milk, so she would be used for meat. And I remember years later going to visit the world headquarters of the Heifer Project in Arkansas, and they were telling me how animals are good for the four M's: meat, milk, manure, and money. And that's what you use them for. And so this is what I was learning back when I was 11 years old, that she wasn't good for milk, so we were going to use it for meat, and she wasn't giving enough milk. So I won't go into the details of the whole thing, but basically... a few of the older campers tried shooting her with this gun point blank in her head, and didn't work. And so then the owner did, and he hit her just in the right spot. And when he did, this cow just crashed to the floor right in front of us. And I was shocked. You know, I was really shocked because a 1,000-pound animal crashes to the floor, and when they do, urine and feces just pours everywhere. And he jumped across her body with this long knife, and just with a very strong stroke, he cut her head off. And the blood went in these arcs through the air, and I can still see it. And he wiped his brow in this kind of matter-of-fact way, and he just told us, you know, if you don't do that, then the blood will be, the meat will be disgusting to us because it'll be full of blood. You know, you've got to have the animal alive when these major arteries are cut. Otherwise, the meat is too blood-soaked, and no one will want it. And so and he showed us on her anatomy and so forth, you know, why she wasn't giving enough milk, and therefore she had to be used as meat. And I learned later, I did a lot of research into slaughterhouse practices and what animals go through in slaughterhouses. And really, whatever animals they are, chickens, turkeys, pigs, cows, the main reason that these animals suffer so horrifically in slaughterhouses is this basic thing, is that, you know, you can't just kill them and then cut them open. They've got to be alive so their hearts are actively pumping the blood out of their necks, so that the meat is not bloody, because we humans don't like bloody meat. So this is why they're very often disemboweled while still conscious, skinned while still conscious, and so forth. And at this organic dairy in Vermont, I got a clear view of the when you look behind the curtain of these operations, these things are always going on. And when we went back to this camp one more year, the following year. And what I remember, I think, and that really, I think, helped me to see something at a deeper level, was that we went down again. It was a beautiful July day again, and the cow was out there, and it was time to, you know, use her for meat again. But this time, Tom, the owner, said, you know, it made such a mess in the floor of the barn, which it did. We're going to take her up to this little grassy knoll. And so we got a rope, we put it around her neck, and we had like 30, 40 kids, and we're trying to pull her up, you know, to this place where we were going to kill her. And we couldn't do it. You know, she was so strongly resisting, we couldn't get her up there. And I think that's another teaching that we really have to let in. You know, we might not want to hear it, but it's important, which is that animals are more conscious very often than we're aware of. I've seen a lot of evidence of this. I've had amazing experiences with animals. They are very aware in many ways. And I think also they don't want to die. You know, there's a deep yearning that we feel. You know, I think one of the things that we have to understand on a deep level, if we can, is that just as I value my life, a chicken values her life, and a cow values her life. I mean, from their point of view, their life is just as important to them as my life is important to me. And we tend, because we're raised in a culture, well, it's just a chicken, it's just a cow, it doesn't matter. But to them, it really does matter. So this cow was resisting with all her might, and we could not pull her. I mean, we could not. She was that strong. So Tom said, no problem. He got a heavy chain, put it around her neck, tied it to the back of his four-wheel drive pickup truck, and he just started going, you know, and she couldn't resist. So she was getting pulled up there. And so we were all kind of running along beside, and I remember I was sitting in the back of the truck. And we got almost up there, and the sort of impossible thing happened, which was she broke the chain. She snapped it. I know. And so the truck lurched forward. We all fell down. I got up. I looked, you know, down back there. I could see this cow, and she was looking up at us, and her head, I mean, I just realized the other day when I was thinking about it how much it must have hurt to be resisting that chain so hard. But anyway, she was looking up at us with this chain dangling down, and she wasn't saying anything, right? I mean, a pig can't stand up here like I am and say, listen, you guys, I mean, I don't think you should kill myself and my kids, and you know, they can't say anything. So she wasn't saying anything. But she was speaking so loudly to me, please don't do this. And I suddenly saw my whole way of seeing shift, because up until that point, she was just a cow. She was just a piece of meat. She was just a source of milk. She was nothing, really. And I saw her as a being. And I thought, just let's not do this. But then I saw her as meat. And I thought, well, you've got to do it. You'll die if you don't eat her, you know. And so I kind of went back and forth. And this, I think, really was the beginning of something that happened inside me at some level. And I think really this is the unyielding dilemma. This is the unyielding dilemma that we in our culture face. We want peace, we want harmony, we want happiness, we want freedom, and yet we deny that to those who are really at our mercy. We deny them peace and freedom. We use them. So I went away to college in Maine, Colby College, and while I was there, I ended up going through some kind of deep sort of spiritual crisis, and I decided I didn't want to go into any corporate world at all. I wanted to go on a spiritual pilgrimage. And so I have a brother 2 years younger than me named Ed, and we talked about what we should do, and we decided we'd go to California. We thought we wanted to find a higher consciousness. We thought, well, I mean, California's got to have it, you know. And this was 1975. And so we took off. We left Concord. We walked. We hitchhiked. We got as far as Buffalo. And when we got to Buffalo, we decided it was getting cold. It was like mid-October. We decided we better head south. I had a bachelor's degree. I could figure that out. Okay, we can head south now. And we walked down. We walked all the way. It took us a few months through upstate New York, Pennsylvania, all the way across West Virginia, and through Kentucky. And we finally walked into Tennessee. And we actually walked all the way to the farm in Tennessee. How many people have heard of the farm? Some of you, great. Wow, that's... Well, they were all from California, mostly, and from San Francisco. And it was a community that I had heard about, actually, when I was at Colby, and I had some interest in, and we just decided, let's just go there. So we walked there. We got there finally at the end of the year, and I suddenly found myself in a community of 800 or so, 800, 900 people that were all vegan. And they didn't even use that word. That word wasn't used back then at all, but at least that I knew of. But it was a community, again, that they didn't wear any, they just didn't use any animal foods, eat any animal foods or use any animal products. And I found that they were happy. They were healthy. You know, this was kind of miraculous. I really hadn't met, maybe I'd met one or two vegetarians finally, but I still really felt that I needed to eat some fish to get enough protein or, you know, something. I just didn't think you could really do it. And but I met real life people. They were healthy, happy. I saw children. You know, there must have been close to 100, maybe 80 kids, vegan from birth in this school, happy and strong. And then they would tell me some stories a little bit, you know, how pigs are castrated without anesthesia and how chickens have their, routinely, and how chickens have their beaks chopped off and are forced to live in these battery cages for eggs and all these horrible things that they do to calves and so forth. And then they were serving all this food that was just a plant-based food that they grew, most of it right there, a lot of it right there. So it was easy. You know, it was very easy. And I remember taking a walk with this guy, and he was showing me around the farm, and he pointed down to his shoes, and he said, "And these are vegetarian shoes." And I thought, wow, they even have vegetarian shoes here. You know, this is amazing. So that was it. That really got the ball rolling. I never ate meat again in my life. That was 1975, and I just thought, this is, you know, it's pretty obvious. You don't need to, so why do it? And but I really did it for that reason of just not wanting to cause suffering. And I don't have time to go into the whole story, but basically, what I think is so important is the idea of community. After living there for a while, I lived in a Zen center in Alabama, if you can believe that. And then Tibetan Buddhist Center in San Francisco for a few years. And then I went eventually to Korea and shaved my head and lived as a Zen monk there. And when I was there, that was very interesting. This was the second time, really, that I lived in a vegan community, because the meditation centers weren't. They were usually some dairy and eggs. This was a vegan, had been a vegan, Songwangsa in South Korea, was a community that had been vegan for 650 years. So just being there, they never talked about it. I mean, for one thing, we were doing a silent retreat. but even if they had, no, it was just permeated everything. This idea that you don't cause suffering, you don't kill. You know, the five precepts in Buddhism: not killing, not stealing, not lying, not committing sexual violence or misconduct, and not causing others to use toxic drugs and so forth. That And ironically enough, these are five things that we do systematically always to animals, and I can talk about that maybe at some point. But you don't do that, and animals are beings. You live in a way that so that the ripples that radiate from my life are ripples of blessing and peace and helpfulness, rather than ripples of killing, stealing, lying, and manipulating, and so forth. So being at Sanglongsa. It was a 90-day silent retreat, and just getting up at before 3 o'clock in the morning and going till 9 o'clock at night, and just sitting in silence. I think I spent so many hours in meditation there and other retreats in the Tibetan Center and other places. I think it helped me somehow to begin to extricate my consciousness out of some of the programming. And I remember when I came back to this culture, finally, it was really difficult, in a sense, to be here. But I felt like I had these roots of veganism that just went so deep into my being. And what is veganism? The word itself was coined by Donald Watson in 1944. And he was the president of the Vegetarian Society in London at the time. And he wanted a new word that was short, because he was tired of typing this long word, vegetarian, all the time. So he made the word vegan. And he just wanted a word that would account for motivation as well, and not just be... And include everything that has to do with dominating animals. So what he said was this: veganism is a philosophy and way of life which seeks to exclude, as far as possible and practical, all forms of cruelty to animals for food, clothing, or any other purpose, and by extension seeks to promote the development and use of animal-free materials for the benefit of humans, animals, and the environment. So veganism is basically simply the yearning and the effort to live a life that does not cause suffering and cruelty to others. Does not cause cruelty to others. And so this is really not a radical idea. I mean, it is radical in our culture, because I don't think we understand how deeply our culture is organized around this. But it's an ancient idea. It's not a new idea. Veganism sounds like a new idea. It's just, since 1944. But in my research, I realized that this is ancient. I mean, the Buddhists, this monastery had been practicing this. We wouldn't eat any animal foods. We didn't wear any, silk or wool or leather. You wouldn't even kill a mosquito in this place. It would be so gauche, it'd kind of go, kill them. you wouldn't do it. So there was this whole mentality of just of kindness, of gentleness, of tenderness, of thinking of others, really. And so when I came back to this culture, and I got my PhD at UC Berkeley and began teaching college classes, I began to feel into how powerful and important it is that we have communities that where people understand this and talk about this. That was the only reason I was able to change, really. It was the farm and Sanglongsa. Otherwise, I never would have got it. There's the example of other people living this was so powerful, and talking about it and explaining and showing recipes and how to do it. Otherwise, how does a culture ever change? The culture cannot evolve unless the individuals in the culture begin to evolve. So what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about the main ideas in the book, and I've already gone into it, I think, basically, but there's specific things that I think it's important to understand. And the main thing is, I think underlying everything, is the importance of what in the Buddhist tradition is called leaving home. Leaving home does not mean you have to, leave home. What it means is to question the underlying assumptions of the culture that we're born into. That's the only way a culture can make any progress, is if the people question the underlying assumptions and begin to have a dialogue and communicate about these underlying assumptions. So leaving home is the key. And once we start doing that, once we start questioning these assumptions and we go deeper and deeper, if we go deep enough, we come to food. Food is the core, I believe. And what this book does, I understood finally that... someone had to write a book. what really happened was, I was teaching these courses. I got my PhD. I was teaching a lot of college courses in San Francisco at San Francisco State University and some other colleges. And I was teaching philosophy, so it's a great position to be in. You know, you can assign books to read. You don't have to read, you know, Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. You have to write papers on, you know. But as I was doing my own research into everything, I started to see how this is a big picture, how everything is connected, how our treatment of animals for food, what's happening to the environment, what happens to women, what happens to our own spiritual nature, how this is all connected. And I began, as Charlie said, I began traveling and doing concerts and lectures. And as time went on, I felt, gosh, someone's going to write a book about this. I mean, it's going to be great to read this book. I mean, it's so obvious. There's a big picture of interconnection here. And I was telling my wife, that book is sure taking them a while to write it. But it's an obvious thing. So finally, I realized if I wanted to read this book, I'd have to write this book. And so that's what I ended up doing. I spent 5 years and did nothing much more than just work on this book, and it came out pretty recently. And the basic idea in the book is, as I said, is that there's this invisible mentality. And so how did it arise? So basically, the first couple of chapters in the book talk about the history of this, and it's very interesting. The thing is, with the book, it's about 300 pages long, and it was even longer, and the editor told me I had to, you know, cut it back, so I don't repeat anything. So I just have to say I cannot go into details about which I really would love to do in the short time that we have. But it's very interesting to understand the history of this. And the brief story is that our culture, I believe, went through a revolution about 10,000 years ago. And I call it the herding revolution, where we began to herd animals. And that changed everything. We began to see beings really as objects. Animals were reduced from being mysterious cohabitants of the world with us to being property. And other animals who were not property were reduced to being pests, ones that would get in the way, might attack our cattle, our sheep, our goats. It happened 10,000 years ago with sheep and goats, about 8,000 years ago with cattle, and it required a huge change. And what I basically believe is that that was the last revolution that our culture experienced. The revolution since then, like the scientific revolution and all these other communication revolution, have not been revolutions at all. They've actually just reinforced the whole thing. They haven't really questioned this underlying mentality of reducing, of reductionism, of reducing beings to things. And so the next revolution will be the revolution where we no longer reduce beings to things. And so that mentality, by the time the historic period emerges, around 4,000 years ago, is well established. It took many thousands of years, many generations for this to happen in the area around the Mediterranean, primarily in Central Asia. And the whole culture changed. We had the first wars, the very wars in the sense of how we see them today, where there's a wealthy elite emerged, which owned the capital. The word capita means head, as in head of cattle. Cattle were wealth. They were reduced to being despicable, but they were wealth. And then the mass of people were soldiers and shepherds that took care of this. Women were reduced to mere chattel property. By the time the historic era emerges, this is obvious in the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Old Testament writings, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the first writings that we have, this is by then established. The very first word on this planet that we know of in the ancient Sanskrit language is the word gavya. Gavya literally translated means the desire for more cattle. Because if you wanted to get rich quick, you stole someone's cattle and then you had a lot of money and you had a lot of capital. That's how it happened. And that required men to be capable of sustained violence. It changed everything. And it spread. And it spread, and it spread, it spread to Europe, it spread when they came here, these people brought their same culture. We're in that culture, we're born into it. And so to understand this, I think is very empowering. The idea that we've always had these things, I don't think is true. The war and so forth. And so the basic historical understanding I go into, but I think the next parts are really interesting. It goes into, to understand some of these, well, to understand the basic nature of intelligence. Intelligence, like I said earlier, is the ability to make connections. So one of the things and that's for any system, an animal, for a human, the ability to make connections that are significant for us, for a culture has intelligence. And so one of the very interesting things is to see that every problem that we have as human beings, we are actually inflicting on animals. The ancient spiritual teachings are relatively straightforward. They say, whatever you do to others will boomerang. You know, as you sow, so shall you reap. Whatever you would want most for yourself, give it to others. Now, these are powerful teachings. Whatever you most ignore will control you the most. All right, so if we understand these things, these ancient teachings of wisdom, we see that if you look at all of the problems, any of the problems that we see in the world, that the on television, on the radio, on the newspapers that we're trying to deal with, we will see that we are doing exactly those things to animals. You know, and yet it's invisible. I'll just give a few examples, but you can think of a lot more. I have a whole section of a chapter that goes into it more in depth. But just briefly, obesity, for example. These animals are sold by the pound. The fatter they are, the more money you get. They're fed special feeds and special hormones to make them as fat as possible. And so we sow seeds of obesity in them, and we get this obesity epidemic. Or osteoporosis is the same thing. You know, osteoporosis is, you know, there's no calcium. I mean, chickens and cows especially, the females are forced to give massive quantities, unnaturally large quantities of milk and eggs, which just sucks all the calcium out of their bones, and they break their bones very easily. That's why so many of the downer cows, basically they're female, they're dairy cows being dragged off to the slaughterhouses, and their bones just break because they've been forced to give so much calcium. We get calcium-rich milk. Yeah, who pays for that calcium? The cows. They don't get it. You know, we steal it from them. And so their bones break, and they get dragged onto the slaughterhouse floor. And so on and on. I mean, living in an increasing, you know, we're talking about how we're living in increasingly toxic environments. We force them into incredibly toxic environments. You can't even breathe in these factory farms. You talk about the breakdown of the family. These animals have no family. We shatter their families. The babies are always stolen from the mothers. There's no family at all. They're reduced to mere objects in a heartless economic system. And we say how, you know, there's more and more alienation and isolation, and people feel disconnected units in a system, an economic system based simply on production and commodification of living beings. Drugs. You know, there's now a situation where more than 50% of the adults in this country are taking a pharmaceutical every single day. You know, and it's spreading. It's growing every year. It's incredible, the profits of the military media medical complex are making. And these animals are, you know, they are forced into, they're drugged, they're just drugged in every possible way you can think of, not only with antibiotics and hormones and all kinds of things. And war and terrorism, they're forced into situations of terror. And it's a war against them. They're in situations of chronic and acute fear, terror, and pain. And so any problem that we can look at, that we have, that we seem to be having, you know, teenage pregnancy, they're forced into pregnancy when they're way before they should ever in the wild be pregnant. The domination of the feminine is a huge thing. It's the female animals that are really most brutally assaulted and controlled and confined in the animal production system. So we have to, this is like basically obvious. This should be obvious. And yet, I could go through an entire bachelor's, master's, PhD program, read hundreds of books, thousands, I mean, books and articles, and never once read anywhere that maybe the reason for our human dilemmas and our human problems could be our brutality towards animals, systematic, ritualized, just routine for food and products. That's an unthinkable thought, really. It's just something we can't even conceive of. I read the most progressive, you know, radical writers, the most spiritual writers, all of them. No one can even articulate this thought. It's been invisible. So this is I think, really the heart of the thing. We are in this culture, killing on a day, well, on a yearly basis, 10 billion land animals, about 20 billion, I mean, we don't know exactly because fish are basically accounted for by the pound, not by the individual, but estimates are around between 17 and 20 billion vertebrate fish. So it's 30 billion animals a year, which, you know, comes down to about 75 million a day. We have to have whole armies of our brothers and sisters that do nothing but slaughter, kill, stab, mutilate, castrate, imprison animals. When we force our brothers and sisters to do stuff we would never want to do, to kill and just do this horrible work, it hurts everybody. We're all connected. When I force someone else to do work that brings out the worst in them, it hurts everybody. And we do this on a massive scale. And so we are so naive to think that we can sow seeds of killing and destruction and slaughter and death on this scale that we're doing, which is, you know, millions. It comes out to, well, I think it's around 70 million a day in this country alone, that these seeds that we're sowing just sort of miraculously disappear into thin air and we just go on our happy lives and it doesn't matter. And so if we truly are serious about world peace, about freedom, about social justice and equality, then this is the huge invisible shadow. Carl Jung said, the larger the shadow is, the harder it is to see. Isn't that ironic? I mean, a little shadow, you can kind of go, ooh, I see that. That's a little thing I do. It's not me. Yeah, okay. The biggest shadow, you can't even see it. You can't even talk about it. It's so big, it just pervades our culture. And it controls us entirely. So, and as you know, you project the shadow. So as we act towards animals, which is heartless, ruthless, devious, we find enemies and we create, you know, we've created enough weapons to destroy the planet many times over, or each other, and we find these enemies as you know, projection is, we find enemies that exhibit the same traits that we ourselves are having. And so the core of our basic dilemma is to recognize how we're actually acting in relation to those beings who are capable of suffering in our hands and who cannot retaliate. And even though they cannot retaliate, they just take it. That's the thing. Whatever we do to pigs, chickens, cows, and all these animals, fish, they have fully developed nervous systems, they suffer enormously, and they cannot retaliate. But our violence towards them retaliates. We experience it in all kinds of ways. What we do to each other, what we do to ourselves, the disease, the violence, the drug addiction, the life that's not lived as a glorious celebration of joy, freedom, and creativity. And we could easily on this planet, there's plenty there's plenty to go around. I mean, right now, we're growing enough food to feed 20 billion people if we fed it to people rather than to animals. And yet we have approximately 1 billion chronically malnourished, approximately 1 billion overweight and obese, while water and resources, petroleum, are wasted at a massive level. Animals are being brutalized. I mean, I honestly, sometimes when I think about this and really go deep into all the statistics and what's actually happening in my travels, seeing what's happening to the earth, I mean, I've been living on the road for 15 years, and I see the corn and soybeans, these massive monocultures, and it's not to feed people, it's to feed humans. And I see how the water's wasted, and I see how these rivers, the Colorado River doesn't even reach the ocean. I mean, what we're doing is absolutely the product of incredible non-intelligence. Intelligence being the ability to make connections. You could almost say, I think, that if we took our most celebrated scientists and just said, create a system that maximizes waste and misery, you'd have it. You know, what we're doing. It's a great system. I mean, if you want to maximize waste and misery and maybe, you know, keep the gargantuan amount of resources for a very tiny elite, it works. But for life and for future generations. So I'm going to check my, okay. So I'm getting short of time. So what I'm going to do is just talk a little bit about a few of the remaining ideas in the book and then go into a little bit more, a little bit of music and then take some questions. So after the chapters on intelligence, there's a chapter which I think is very important called The Intelligence of Human Physiology, which is basically to understand our physiology. And under the bottom line is, I believe, we have all been given bodies by the universe, whatever we call the benevolent source of all life, that truly require no animal to suffer to feed them. We do not need to, there's no nutrient that you cannot get from plants that is in animal foods. The nutrients are all there. I mean, I've been a vegan for 25 years, and I have not bought a pill in 25 years. I mean, it's really possible to have an incredibly high level of energy and joy and vitality on a plant-based diet. And so we've been given this gift, but we've been, again, forced by our culture, by growing up in our culture, to believe that, no, you have to eat animal foods. And this, I think, is the great tragedy. So we take that gift and we throw it back in the face of the benevolent creator and say, anyway, we're going to kill animals and eat them. And we don't need to. If you look in the any grocery store, you just go to the baby food section, and you'll see right there, you'll see little jars. There are jars of peaches and peas. There are also jars of veal and chicken and beef and cheese and macaroni. All this. So we lose our mother's breast and we get it right there. And it's the programming is incredible. And I don't have time to go into it, but I do in here. The programming on a species level to eat animal foods is so powerful. It comes from every institution, from the family, from government, from religion, from science, the military has now become an institution from the government. And so for us to actually awaken and challenge this and question this takes really a powerful, deep, I think, spiritual transformation. The next chapter is, an important chapter, which is called The Hunting and Herding of Sea Life. What's happening to our oceans and to sea animals is really important to understand. And the devastation of our oceans is having a huge effect on all life. Then there's a chapter called The Domination of the Feminine, which I would love to talk about more. But basically, it goes into what I think is, in a sense, the heart and soul of the book, which is that the feminine principle is so vital. We all know this, I think, and so sacred. The functions of females, to nurture the young, to create nurturing environments for the babies, to nurture them, to give birth. And these are the very functions that are most brutally savaged by our system. And I go into it in the book, but I don't have time now. But basically, if you just look into dairy, is just one brief example, the female cow would live 25 years in the wild. After 4 to 5 years, they are worn out and sent off to slaughter. They're impregnated after just 1 year. This would never happen in the wild. Their babies, as soon as they, after being pregnant for 9 months and giving birth, that baby is always stolen. The milk is stolen. And they're immediately re-impregnated, which breaks down the health of any mammal very quickly. Instead of giving 25 pounds of milk a day, they're encouraged or forced, really, to give about 110 pounds of milk a day. The way they get them to do that is by feeding them, two ways, feeding them lots of hormones, prolactin, progesterone, estrogen, and by feeding them cholesterol. Cholesterol is not a plant food, so they enrich their feed. They call it enriched. It sounds great, right? They enrich their feed with fish, with chicken, with poultry, with meat byproducts, roadkill. It comes from the renderer. Traditionally, they always enrich the feed with other cows, with their own babies probably, because there's many more babies born on a dairy than you can ever use. If there's not a veal market, then you just cut them up and goes back into the feed for the other animals. So we're turning these cows as routine procedure for decades, not only into carnivores, but into cannibals, even eating their own babies. And this is standard procedure on dairies. And so what these mothers are enduring, to have their babies stolen, to be forced to eat this feed, to give way more milk than they ever would give, and they'd be killed young, it would take people that are so disconnected from their intuitive, gentle, conscious wisdom to do that, and it suppresses that so strongly. And this is what's going on, and it's just standard procedure on factory farms. It's been the whole system of factory farms would never be possible without the control of the female estrous cycle. That is the heart of the whole thing. So anyone who's interested at all in these connections and truly liberating the feminine aspect within our culture and ourselves, you've got to look right there at dairy and eggs. And chickens are treated even much worse than cows, if that's possible, but I think they are. So we have to understand these things and not believe the propaganda coming from all these organic, you know, dairy industry. I saw that myself when I was a kid. The metaphysics of food is another chapter that goes into how our reductionist science and religion have changed our way of our natural wisdom to know that there's energy in food. It's not just a physical thing. There's actual vibration that we're partaking of. So I go into that in that chapter. There's a chapter called Reductionist Science and Religion. Again, this is very important to understand how the father of our culture is the herding mentality. The two sons are religion and science. And people say, oh, they are always they're on opposite sides of the coin. That's not true. They are two bickering brothers, and they're very happy with each other, actually. And they both turn with ferocity towards at Sophia, the intuitive wisdom, the feminine wisdom within us. They attack her. That's the real enemy and to them. But that's our real savior. So science and religion bring materialism. They bring, in many ways, they reinforce this whole thing. So I go in more depth into this. But we have to question things at the deepest possible level, really. And they have a chapter on called The Dilemma of Work, which is really about the suffering that men endure. Men have been forced to disconnect from our feelings through this whole process and work and how that has evolved. There's a whole chapter called Profiting from Destruction, which is really about the environmental devastation caused by our food choices. And basically, this is a huge subject, but there's nothing sustainable about this system. It's coming out more and more every day. The global warming, the driving force behind global warming now is, according to the UN report, Livestock's Long Shadow, one of the largest factor is livestock. And yet it's not talked about. I could go on and on about this. You have to understand these things. It's in my book. It's all in here. And then the last few chapters, I try to get more positive here. The last few chapters are the fact is that it's a very positive situation in the sense that this is something we can all change. I mean, everything about it is doable. Everything about it is doable. It just takes the will to do it. Anyone in here, anyone we know, can say, okay, I understand. I'm going to stop eating animal foods. I'm going to stop paying people to torture and confine and kill animals and eat their flesh and secretions. We can all do that. And then we can not only do that, we can spread the word. And as we do that, it will create the real revolution. I mean, I don't think we can imagine to visualize a world that where people no longer live the way we've been forced to live, seeing beings as things, is to visualize a world where peace is really possible, where sustainability is possible. I mean, if we could allow vast areas of land to go back to forests and be wildlife habitat, there's plenty of food. We can grow plenty of food. Local sustainable agriculture, plant-based agriculture would easily feed everyone. The underlying driving fury of racism, of feminism, all these things is this mentality of privilege, this mentality of exclusion that's ritually injected into us by our meals as children that we learn to see. Well, we keep our sphere of compassion right here and we don't include others. What veganism is simply is looking out of eyes that see beings and not things. It's nothing to be proud of. It's nothing, you know, it's just seeing how we naturally see. As soon as we wake up from this cultural entrance that we've been put into, we see with these eyes. These are our true eyes. And they're eyes that see truly and with kindness and compassion for all life. And this is our heritage, I believe. And as we awaken to that and we begin to live that, we become a field of freedom. And we become a field of kindness and compassion that can then radiate into our society. It'll radiate into our communities. It'll radiate through all of our institutions, into our churches, into our government, into our educational systems. It radiates everywhere. So wherever you're in, whatever you're in, whatever institution you're in, you can work through that institution to bring these values. But the most important thing is to live it. And the living of it means pulling out the weeds that our culture has planted. So not only, I think, are we called to live with kindness and compassion for others, animals, but for humans. And we're not allowed the luxury of anger and fury at others. We have to understand, be understanding. It really means a deep inner change. at the deepest level. So I just want to thank all of you for making these efforts. And I think what I'd like to do, we'll take, I want to have some time for questions. I want to move, because I want to move into a little bit into a short piece of music, because I think we can talk almost forever about these things, and it's important to understand the underlying ideas. But basically what this is really about is a feeling. It's the feeling that we can have when we look out of our eyes at nature, at animals, at others. And I think that feeling in many ways has been killed out of us by our culture. We've been taught to look with eyes that see things and see cost-benefit analysis. But to look at, to see the preciousness and beauty of life. So I'd like to play a piece of original music. I travel the country and play concerts. And where we used to live a little while in Northern California, we had a house that had a lot of mice that lived in that when we moved in. It was like overrun with mice. It was a beautiful house way out in Northern California. And so I remember I used to, for a little while, I had to like transport them. And I had a mouse on the piano one afternoon, and I just tuned into her, I just looked at her, and I started playing. And this melody just came out of this mouse, believe me. It's like her music. So what I'd like to do is just invite you, as you're listening to the music, to just think of an animal that you can relate to somehow. Maybe a companion animal, a dog or a cat or a bird, or maybe an animal, a wild animal, a chipmunk or a cardinal or a deer or an animal you've seen in a zoo or an animal you've seen in a picture or a whale or a dolphin. I don't know. Just think of an animal or just see what comes up and open to this presence, the life. Animals celebrate their lives. One of the things that we hate to admit is that these animals maybe have a purpose other than, you know, our purpose, that they're here just for us to use. But they really have a purpose, and that their lives have amazing dignity and qualities of intelligence. Just spend time with animals. Anyway, so I'd like to just play this piece, and then this little mouse piece, and just open up to the web of all life. And when I'm finished, I'm going to play one other piece called Benediction, where we can just send our blessings into the world, and then I'll take a few questions. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, I really want to thank you again all for joining us. We have a few minutes if anyone has a pressing question. I know that we've just created a field of healing and blessing and sent it out into the world. I guess, yeah, you need to go to the microphone if you're going to ask. So I think you have to go to the microphone. It has to be on the microphone.
I think I have a short question.
Okay.
Actually, it has to do with, I'm relatively new to some of this. And I was always told that you can't get B12 from anything except
I can talk
about
it.
Help.
Okay.
Because
B12 was always for millions of years available to us because we didn't chlorinate the water and industrially wash all our produce. So because of, you know, it's B12 is made by bacteria. So since we've chlorinated the water, it kills off most of the B12. So it's probably a good idea to take you only need a little bit, a few micrograms, but probably good. That's the only substance you really need to. I want to say we're going to be, since it's almost time to go, going back to the UFIDA, Unitarian Universalist for the Ethical Treatment of Animals table, and I'm happy to sign books there. I have books and CDs there, and there's literature more about, if you buy the book, you get a free CD about the main ideas in the book, and something by my wife called Intuitive Cooking. And there's also some great literature just on vegetarian starter kits and so forth for more information. And so to just bring this message out into the world is so important, and it's the best thing we can do to help each other and our future generations and all life. Yes?
What's your feeling or thoughts of if we have dogs, cats, about feeding our animals, yeah. our pet animals, a
okay.
vegetarian diet.
I think it's good if you can, you know, dogs, there's no problem. The dogs are easy vegans. Cats, especially male cats, sometimes it's difficult, so you have to kind of, but there is vegan cat food and dog food, so do some research on it. There's a book called The Obligate Carnivore and other, I mean, so it's, you can, you know, do some more research and find out the possibilities, but dogs are easy. Yeah.
What's the scoop on vegetarian cage-free eggs? Are those acceptable?
Okay, what's the scoop on vegetarian cage-free eggs? Well, okay. Anyway, free range, so-called free range, I go that into it in my book a little bit more, but it has no legal meaning, really. So very often these animals are in stinking sheds their entire lives. They're never outside, typically. I mean, most of the so-called free range eggs are come from places like that where they're not out running around. Okay, well, I know it is 2:15, and so I want to thank all of you for joining us, and please keep up the good work you're doing. All right, thank you.